The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Welcome everyone again to City Bible Forum Legal. My name is Peter Calder, if we haven't met before, and of course we have the honour of welcoming back Professor Edwin Judge. Edwin spoke last week on the origin of atheism, and if you missed that talk, it's available as a podcast up on our website, so I'll encourage you to download that. And without any further ado, I'm going to welcome Edwin to address us on the theme of the religion of secularists.
Well, thank you, and I've given you on the sheet of paper on the table everything that I was intending to say. It's extremely dense, as you can see. And so if I leave you in confusion, just go back to that, and that's what it was that I was supposed to be saying. The first point is about what on earth is meant by religion. I call it there two-faced in historical terms, or bipolar, because what the Romans meant by the Latin word religio was something like taboo or scruple, and not at all what we now mean by religion. Indeed, what we now mean by religion, which in my judgment is a kind of intellectual with social commitment, which ties you or leads you to a certain view of the world, and certain social obligations and so on, roughly that's what we now mean by religion, that in Roman times would have been called superstition, which was also a Roman term. And in fact, the first comment that we have from what might be called an independent observer of the Christians in the Roman world, Pliny, was that it was a superstition. And he tells us why, because when he tortured two deaconesses to find out what it was that was driving them, he discovered that it was only superstition. The deaconesses, I conjecture, gave him a thoroughgoing lecture on Christian doctrine, you see. And so what it was that the Romans hated about this zone of life was intruding argumentation and obligation into it. There was, of course, a kind of ancestral obligation in religio, but above all, you should not question it. Cicero, for example, a famous philosophical skeptic, probably didn't even believe in the gods, but nevertheless, like all Roman noblemen, I think, thought it was the right thing to do whatever was the right thing. And the great Roman antiquarian, Varro, writing in Cicero's time, attempted, as a modern anthropologist would, to explain the Roman cults. And after book, he admitted defeat. He could not explain what the reason for them was. By contrast, the philosopher Seneca in Paul's time said of the Jews, rather regretfully, I think, they know the reasons for what they do. This is the great characteristic of what is called the Judeo-Christian tradition. It is an intellectual tradition that explains the world, creates obligations within it, and so on. And one knows very conspicuously in the case of Judaism. The letter to James, or a letter, sorry, of James in the New Testament, chapter 1, verse 27, says, in Greek, of course, which doesn't have a word, I may say, for religion, he says, your piety, threskeia in Greek, if it's pure and uncontaminated, is, what do you think he said? To sacrifice? No, though he was a Jew. He said, to watch over the widows and the orphans. That is the unblemished life. So this is the social commitment, as well as the intellectual commitment, which Judaism and the gospel brought to the zone which we now call religion. And it is this incommensurate view of things across the ages that gets us into such a tangle today over religion and secularism, because what has happened with the churches is that they did not maintain their intellectual, social commitment in its pure form, but they absorbed the cultic practice of the country where they were, Roman practice and so on. And so great churches today, and even little ones, are a tangle, in my opinion, between the distinctive so-called superstition, i.e. the thinking, arguing, doing side of life, and the customary conservative, protective side. When we want everything to be just the same in church, like I do, I hate anything being changed, we're functioning like old-fashioned Roman religionists. We don't care what it is, just don't change it. That's religion, in the old sense. But when the secularists go on about religion, it's religion in the modern sense that they don't like. They don't want the churches, they in fact don't mind churches. Most people who are secularists, I think, and atheists for that matter, find it rather sweet and attractive that people should stay with their age-old customs, which of course are incomprehensible, but they're just beautiful. So no one in our culture will criticize anybody else's religion in the Roman sense and just wish that the Christians would stay with it and not obtrude into the public arena with argumentation and so on. So in this bipolar sense, the churches themselves are in a tangle, and the community, of course, also. But the secularists, I think, are trying to ban the modern sense of religion and would happily embrace, I guess, the ancient sense. Well, that's point one. If you don't understand what I'm saying, there it is in three lines on a piece of paper. Two, the first person whom one could call a secularist, that name wasn't used, but who acted in public life was Julian, the last survivor of the House of Constantine. He was brought up a believer in the gospel, but rejected it as a young man and kept his rejection to himself until he came to power as the ruler of Rome. Then he set out with a vengeance to obliterate what the Christians had been doing and to reinstate the ancient cults of Greece and sharply to differentiate the Christians from that. Christians themselves had been condemning the cults, but the trouble is, according to Julian, they had then been teaching the great poets of Greece, Homer and so on, which everybody had to learn at school, even though they did not believe in the gods of Homer. In other words, he saw the Christians as hypocrites. They were all learning at school and sending their children to school where they learned things that in their view were wrong. This is true. The Christians recognized this, and they had the counter for it in what they did in church and at home. But Julian reacted that way because, of course, he was a former believer, and he still held the principles, instinctively, if you like, in which he'd been brought up, and he couldn't tolerate this contradictory behavior. So he banned believers from teaching in public schools. This is a very secularist. That's why I call it a secularist action on his part, and ordered, he didn't want to injure Christian children, so he ordered the churches to invent their own schools and try teaching Greek out of the New Testament, which would, of course, have been very philologically inadequate by classical standards. But this was the first time that the idea of church schools had raised itself 300 centuries on, after the Roman Empire was already falling under the control of Christian belief. It only lasted a few months before Julian himself lost his life in battle and the matter was quietly buried. In Paul's speech at Athens, Acts 17, verse 29, he discredits the man-made gods, but refers to that epoch down to the time of the gospel as the times of ignorance which God would overlook and which demanded repentance before the coming day of judgment. So there is a clear-cut case preserved for us in that version of Paul's speech of the intellectual impact of what the gospel implied. Point three. Ammianus is the last great historian of Rome. He was in fact a Greek, but wrote in Latin, and he was an intense admirer of Julian, although also critical of him. He thought Julian was wrong to debar the Christians from teaching in the secular schools. He also does not use the term secular, which is a Latin term. At least I haven't checked that, but I assume he doesn't. But the interesting thing about him, and this is something that you won't read in any of the books because it's something that occurred to my feeble mind, Ammianus makes frequent reference in his history to Christians, and people have often wondered whether he was himself, like Julian, a lapsed believer. I'm convinced he wasn't. And although his references to the Christians are extremely illuminating, they are also blind in important respects. For example, unlike Julian, who had been brought up in it, he did not understand the argumentativeness of the Christians. He thought it was all horrific. In fact, he complained that it was wrecking the public transport system because they kept holding synods, that it meant bishops had to go from end to end of the Roman Empire only to quarrel with each other, as far as Julian could see. And he had nothing but horror for this behaviour. He did not see what you might call the powerful sense of commitment, including specifically intellectual commitment and doctrinal and personal commitment, that was causing this admittedly horrifying scene. But the main point I want to make about Ammianus is printed there on the sheet. In everything he says about the Christians, there is never the slightest terminological or other indication that they had anything to do with the ancient sense of religion. That is, they do not worship any god. There is no god referred to in connection with the Christians. There is nothing sacred. They have no sacred building, no altar, no sacrifice. The whole vast terminology of cult, that is, the conservative security system of ancient culture, equivalent to what one might call ethnic traditions in our communities today, how we cling to our own tradition, that whole side had nothing to do with the Christians. Ammianus doesn't say that. I'm saying it on the basis of the fact that he simply fails to identify the Christians with that, even though we know from Christian sources that they were, in fact, at that very time, going over to treating their own affairs in a quasi-sacral manner. That is, they were starting to talk as though they had a sacrificial system themselves, a quasi-sacrificial system and so on. And this, of course, is the origin. The 4th century merger of the two traditions, the two religions, if you like, was going on around Julian. The fact that he couldn't see it, though a very acute contemporary observer, shows that it hadn't got very far in his day. Point four. The idea of secularity as it's used in our time, we owe to Augustine. Augustine is the greatest author of antiquity, writing in Latin. to judge at any rate from the huge volume of his work that survives and the huge modern discussion that it still inspires in every discipline of the academic spectrum. Augustine himself had grown up, like Julian, in a Christian household and drifted away from it in one way or another in his youth, as he describes, and came back to it through a famous conversion and a series of other conversions that you might identify in his complicated life. And it was he, in his grand work called The City of God, who hammered out for us the understanding of the world that we all now inherit in the West and which lies behind the idea of secularity, because the term seculum, which gives us secularity, is the Latin word for what might be called centenary or something like that, because the Romans celebrated the seculum. It means literally, I think, we don't know the origin of the word, so I shouldn't say literally, but in terms of usage, a seculum is an era, or and the Romans themselves argued about how often you had one, whether it was 100 years or 110 years and so on. But periodically the Romans celebrated a new seculum, a new era. But it was rotatory. It wasn't like the biblical eras, which are cumulative and go in one direction only through time. But the Roman ones went round and round, as we do with the word centenary and so on. So the Roman culture was conscious of this notion of the distinctive age to which one belonged. And Augustine applies this term to the state of affairs in which we belong by our culture, in contrast to the state of affairs to which we belong by our belief in the God of the Gospel. And the latter he called the City of God, and the other was your ordinary city, Rome, in his case. And it's not that the two are enemies of each other, because they are both, for a believer, they are both where God has put you. They have very different destinies. That's what distinguishes them. It is not merely church and state that he's talking about, because he was deeply critical of the church, as people in church always are, their own churches, and should be, as defective. And of course, he was both critical and protective of the state, because he saw the state, as indeed Jesus had signaled, as having its obligations under God. When Jesus said, "We're given the coin, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's," he did not mean, presumably, that there was a clear-cut distinction. There is one in principle, obviously. But his answer, remember, dumbfounded his critics who raised the question, because there is an ambiguity. Jesus doesn't spell it out, but it's spelled out by Paul, who explains that the rulers to whom you owe the obligation to render to Caesar are, in fact, the ones God has appointed for your good, and you should render them not only their tax, but honor and so on, as Paul says in the letter to the Romans. So this view of the nature of power in the world is extraordinarily clear and influential in the thinking of Augustine. This duality, or built-in contradiction, if you like, is temporary, belonging to this age only, the secular age, if you like. But it's embedded there in our culture. It's embedded for everybody in our minds. Whether a believer or an unbeliever, everybody is bound by our tradition now. The way we think, talk, and so on and so on, in all sorts of ways, ties us all to this double citizenship. And we know that by the high degree to which our tradition admires commitment, individual commitment against authority and so on. The secularists themselves are campaigners, as indeed believers are, and they share the same posture, therefore, in the way the community works, just attaching themselves to a different ideal. Just as a piece of light relief, I've offered you my not-so-bright thought on number five, on the interesting year 529. Nobody, so far as I know, has ever said that this was the actual year in the history of the West, but there you are. I suggest it. I'm only partly serious because I don't mean to say that these four things, all of which occurred in that year, are good things. In fact, there's only one of them I think is a good thing. The others I question the value of. And what are they? These things all occurred in the one year under the rule of Justinian. And the first, of course, was his great codification of the Roman law, which, to my mind, is shaping the world increasingly. I know the common law in the Anglo-Saxon tradition is a different deal, but it's not Anglo-Saxon law which is making the modern world. It is the high doctrine of universal law. That's why we have these globalized institutions which lay down the law to us now, or try to, or some people want them to, and so on. International law. This grows out of the Justinianic tradition that the law can be codified as a matter of principle and high doctrine into what one can and can't do. And it began then. The second thing that occurred in that year was that Justinian, being a passionate believer, determined that non-believers might no longer study. They were to be shut out. Meaning by that, the state would not pay for high-level philosophy to be maintained as it had been across 1,000 years. It hadn't been paid for by the state across 1,000 years, but increasingly, as that millennium wore on, that culminates in 529, the state had been paying for the top academics in the great university cities to continue giving their lectures at public expense. That was cancelled by Justinian, unless they were believers. And it led to a profound and dramatic event. The Academy of Plato, that is his school in Athens, ceased. It's not as though Justinian had ordered it to cease, just that he disqualified its teachers from teaching at public expense. And according to the tradition, they migrated to Mesopotamia and sought refuge there in a profound shift of intellectual focus, really, which led in the next century with Islam to the flowering of Greek science in Arabic language. So that was an important thing. I don't, of course, think that was a good thing. Anybody who's trying to exclude anybody from the debate has already lost the argument, I think. The third thing is the publication in Alexandria, the reigning intellectual capital and far outshining Athens in recent centuries by 529, the philosopher Philoponos systematically refuted the doctrine of the eternity of the universe. This was the distilled conclusion of 1,000 years of Greek philosophy. That is, though the Greek philosophers argue about everything, the one thing that they all agreed on was the ultimate character of the universe itself. That is, the universe itself was everything there is. It was complete, perfect, and above all, eternal. The whole of the modern understanding of the world derives directly from the rejection of that doctrine. It is the book of Genesis which says the world is not complete, it is not eternal, it is not fixed, it is not unchanging. It began, was made, and will end. That is exactly what the whole world now, at last, well, the learned world, and I think the Western world in general, believes to be the case. And it believes to be the case because the methodology of science had been shattered by the biblical doctrine. And it was this year, 529, this is obviously the one that I think is right in these four and of ultimate consequence. It was in this year that Aristotle's doctrine was systematically refuted. Proclus was the leading Platonic philosopher at this time, and Philoponus, his critic, subsequently refuted Aristotle's version of eternity as well. And so the doctrine that the world is all there is and will always be here was technically gone in this year. It took a long time, another 1,000 years, for the consequences to shake out in natural science. But by our lifetime, that has prevailed. The fourth thing, which I don't think is great consequence, is, quaintly enough, that the Ecclesiastical Council in southern France at Vraison, the Second Council of Vraison that year, ordained that every parish must run a school. This, if you like, fulfills Julian's requirement, but for strange reasons. It was because by that time access to public education was deeply failing, and for the recruitment of ministers in the church, ordinary literacy was necessary, and consequently the parishes would have to undertake general education. There are three things. I've forgotten what I have to stop. In 3 minutes or what? The last three points are my three propositions about what it is that secularists now are defending. And my simple comment is that each of these high values are, of course, shared by everybody in the community, and above all, they stem from the biblical culture and not from the doctrine of an eternal universe. The first is the understanding of the universe itself. It stems, of course, from the application of experimental method to science. That had been rejected in the splendid speculations of Greek philosophy. They knew about the experimental method. Obviously, they were observers and analyzers. But their ultimate test for truth was not experiment, but definition and rationality and logic. But what was brought against that by the Christians in particular and the Jews was the test of experience. And out of that grew the experimental method, which in early modern times finally released from the long lingering weight of Greek rational philosophy, began to pick the universe apart to see how it works. So everything that now engulfs us with the explosion of the world of knowledge and indeed the whole global culture stems from this method, which is the biblical method. Testing is one of the great motifs of the biblical culture. God tests you, and you should test him, is what the Bible is saying. The second thing that we all value is the open society. That stems specifically from the challenge of the churches in the second century on the question of truth. And in the great criticism of the churches by Celsus, they were held to be in breach of the common law, i.e. universal law, was defied by the Christians behaving on separate principles. And Origen, who refuted Celsus's thing, and we have this refutation, lays down at the beginning of his book the remarkable principle, unheard of until this point, that it is not wrong to disobey the law in the name of truth. No one had said that before. The law, by definition, was an inescapable obligation in a unified, rational universe. But Origen promulgated the biblical principle that there was something other than law. And that was truth. Don't ask me how he defined truth. But by challenging whatever was agreed and held to be universal, he opened the way to what we call the alternative society, which everybody now values. And third and last, what I call the open heart. In ethics, in the ancient culture, one guarded one's heart, as it were. The term heart, as a figure for the emotional life, is a biblical term. One might as well say mind or something else, a soul. But heart was the distinctively biblical term. But above all, it was the exposure of one's heart, which you'll find in Paul's letters in an extremely vivid and agonizing way, which was unique to this tradition, because the ethical tradition guarded oneself against overexposure. Most of us are very ethically inclined for that reason today. We guard our souls, and yet we admire tremendously those who let it go and open their heart, who show compassion. And that comes from the challenge of the biblical tradition, and Jesus in particular, on the fraudulence of hypocrisy, that is, pretending to be righteous when you know that you're in fact deceiving. I'll leave it at that, and you can digest the pills on the piece of paper later. Now, where's Peter gone? Oh, he's collecting the damage. Incidentally, while he's doing that, this very month there was published in this city, because I received a copy just yesterday, of a book by Paul Barnett called Paul, that's not him, but the Apostle Paul, A Pastor's Heart in 2 Corinthians, which is a treatment of the emotional crises of St. Paul, which were also, along with Augustine, a tremendous window into the inner life, which had been bottled up and denied under the rationalizing system. Here's a pile of questions. I'll just take them as I come. Wasn't Justinian's approach to law a static, classical approach, even though he was a Christian believer? Well, yes, it was. How does one explain this contradiction? Well, have you ever met inconsistent Christians before? Do cult and culture have the same root source? Yes, they do. Cult is simply the translation of the Latin word for cultivation, which means cultivation of plants or cultivation of the soul or cultivation of anything. That is the deliberate attention to shape things in a profitable way. And cult was doing that. We use the word cult now in a negative sense in order to condemn the ones we don't like. But there is no negative sense in my use of the word cult of ancient so-called religion. That was simply the enshrining of customary practice on the strength that it was customary and therefore good for the future. So the answer to that question is yes. Next question, public education in Greece and Rome. There was such a thing only at the high level in later centuries. Were there philosophical chairs provided at public cost? Otherwise, there was dispute in minor cities, in Egypt, for example, about whether there should be public education at what we would call high school level. And we actually have a letter from a public teacher who had been deprived of his source of income, which in terms of a property endowment, and was trying to get it back. In other words, they did endow a certain amount of public education, but basically, and especially at the elementary level, there was no public provision. That person is springing two questions on me, and the second question is, what did Origen think truth was? That would take me too long, I'm sorry, and I don't know the answer. The next question, is there a proven connection? Oh, I should say, however, in defense of Origen, he was a mammoth expositor of Scripture, and we have vast quantities of his work. So, in general, he obviously took what might be called a biblical view of truth. Next question, is there a proven connection between Justinian's exclusion of non-believers from the academies and the rise of Islam? Yes, there is a connection. And what are the connections? Well, by making academic work exclusive and obligatory, that is, you couldn't do it if you were a non-believer, this is Justinian's position, he establishes the trap. And the trap in Islam, in my opinion, is that it locks you in to a total system of understanding, belief and practice, and you are not free to abandon it. It's not as though you can't join Islam, as I understand it. You can, but it's trying to get out of it that puts your life in danger. So it is this ironclad, exclusivist aspect of it, which is the heritage of Justinian's attempt to entrench Christian doctrine as necessary for academic truth. That's wrong, in my view. The next question is, holding the Roman coin, render unto Caesar what is Caesar. Did Jesus mean that the Jews should reject the Roman monetary system and by implication reject Rome? Well, he certainly didn't mean that, I think. Indeed, you can see from the episode, people didn't take it that way at the time. Had Jesus meant to reject the system, he would have lodged the obvious objection to the coin. It had Caesar's portrait on it, and that was taboo, and more than taboo in Jewish law, obviously. It was contrary to the ban on graven images. And yet Jesus held the coin in his hand and says, if it's Caesar's, give it back to him. So in a way he rejects it, if you like, by saying, give it back to him. But on the other hand, his answer, of course, is ambiguous. And it is rightly, in my opinion, unraveled by Augustine in his famous Doctrine of the Two Kingdoms, which coexist, one with ultimate reality and the other God's temporary rule. So I think Jesus would have said, if you'd pin him down in this kind of debate, that yes, Caesar was there by God's permission. This indeed was the view taken by the Old Testament prophets over the great kings of Persia, for example. They were God's Messiah for the time. Next question. Should Christians have chosen the pagan festival day of December to celebrate the birth of Christ? Well, of course they shouldn't, in a way. It confuses things. But this is part of that absorption. One of the main things I'm saying in all this is that the Christian movement, having conquered the Roman world by force of its ideas and behavior, nevertheless then began to absorb its customary practices. And Christmas is a clear-cut case. Do you know the Puritans and the Presbyterian Church in its more strict life shunned Christmas for that reason? The problem now, of course, is I tried to shun Christmas when we were rearing children, but it just didn't work. I mean, you can't get out of it. And so the only thing to do is to make the best of a bad job, I suppose. And what's wrong with it anyway? What's wrong with it is the rotatory principle that it embodies, in my opinion, by suggesting that the world works by things that come round again the same every year. We are misconstruing the way the world works. That's the rational, eternal view of the cosmos. There will always be a Christmas and so on. Well, there won't, is the biblical doctrine. So in a strange way, at the lofty level, I suppose, the church defeats itself. And yet, every minister must know this. If you don't go along with it, you miss a golden opportunity to spell out the inner meaning of the coming of the Messiah. So don't think I'm You know, I love old customs and so on, but there you are. Next question on the same sheet. Should the date of Easter be changed from being the Sunday on or after the first full moon? Well, of course, yes. That's, again, part of the rotatory system, you see. Fortunately, the churches disagree on the date of Easter, so that keeps the matter alive. The next thing is... That's them all. I've finished. I'm sorry, I think I've found another one. Can I expand on the significance of Philoponus refuting the eternity of the cosmos? Well, I could, of course, but I thought I'd said it, that the whole character of our modern understanding of the world follows from the rejection of the eternity of the cosmos. This is the great intellectual watershed in all history, in my view. The West is the only cultural stream known on Earth which rejects the permanence of what is. The other great cultural traditions cling to fixity. The Aboriginal tradition does. With respect, Chinese culture is deeply attached to principles of fixity and so on. It is only in this alarming Western paradox, self-contradicting, if you like, two things at once, the city of God and the city of Rome together, that this explosive, dangerous, my problem with it is that the kingdom of God that we're having? I doubt it. But that's the question. When does the kingdom of God come?
Well, on that dramatic note, we draw these 2 weeks to an end. Let's thank Edwin once again.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.